The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. How do you deal with the past when it hurts too much to spend time there? My guest this week is writer and journalist Daniel Villarreal, who found himself questioning his purpose in life when the authorities he'd always trusted, like the church and his father, revealed themselves not to have his best interests at heart. He managed to cut himself free from harmful relationships, but he was still left with the questions of how to move on, a question he's still in the process of mastering. And just a heads up, in our conversation, we'll be talking about some abuse, both in Daniel's life and the lives of people he's written about. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on June 20th at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And if you're looking for more queer podcasts, check out my narrative comedy shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends for an escape into a world of fantasy with drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. You can subscribe to both shows at queensofadventure.com or search your favorite podcast app. Now, here's Daniel. Well, this week I'm speaking with Daniel Villarreal. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I found that video games were a really influential medium growing up, and back when I was a youngster in the 80s and early 90s, a lot of people weren't really upfront about their playing video games. I mean, the Nintendo console had just come out, and you had a handful of kind of computer geeks if their parents were kind of wealthy enough to have a computer on hand. But even then, the game supply was relatively minor. So at the time, it's not like tons of people were necessarily playing Super Mario Brothers or playing Ghosts and Goblins. Maybe they had seen them in the arcades, but not a lot of people actually had these consoles in their homes, at least where I was growing up in Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, not only was it sort of a limited, knowledge base, not everyone kind of knew about the secret world that I would go to, you know, after school and enjoyed spending my time on. But for those who did know, they ended up kind of being a sort of club or a sort of a small escapist group that sort of understood what you were talking about when you were talking about Metroid or Mike Tyson's Punch-Out or Castlevania or things like that.
So what were these like places that you would go? Like you're talking about like – are these basements of friends' homes, or are we talking about like arcades or what?
It's usually just friends' bedrooms, but what I meant by places we go, I meant more so that you spend your evenings like going and slaughtering monsters in Dracula's castle in Castlevania, mm-hmm. or that you're discovering the inner depths of like the Lone Planet of Brimstar in Metroid. And, you know, you would be immersed in these worlds and their music and their enemies and colors and their atmosphere for, you know, hours and hours on end. And when you go back to school, you try to tell your friends about them, but they either don't know what these games are. They just flat out didn't care. They were just like, oh, that sounds really dorky. They were into sports or TV or other things. But they were so forward thinking at the time. I mean, these games, they combined a lot of things that I liked, in terms of, you know, different bits of literature. I mean, you know, different monsters, like in Castlevania, you have, you know, like Medusas and Draculas and shapeshifters and, you know, all these kind of different literary monsters. And then you have these really, really excellent, complex types of electronic music that kind of back in the day, I mean, you had sort of Kraftwerk and some Brian Eno, but, you know, and synthesizers coming up and kind of new wave music, but there wasn't really a ton of electronic music that I was aware of growing up as a kid. And so these were some of my first exposures to sort of high energy, upbeat electronic music that just made me feel a certain way that, you know, I don't know if it's kind of my younger queer self getting ready for, you know, the age of club music, but yeah, they just kind of created an excitement and a thrill in me that was unlike anything that I ever really felt listening to, say, classical music or like my mom's Julio Iglesias records or things like that.
Did you have game moments that stuck with you?
I think when anyone finally beats, Dr. Wily at the end of Mega Man 2, it's a long go. It's not necessarily an easy game, even though it's one of the easier in the Mega Man world. And this sounds really, maybe it doesn't sound so silly these days, but I felt it was really silly back then, is that, you know, you finally beat Dr. Wily in alien form. And then all of a sudden, Mega Man is kind of looking out on this, like, you know, country landscape after having kind of fought his way through a futuristic, robotic, apocalyptic hellscape. And it was kind of really beautiful. The music is serene, the colors are really nice. At the end of Super Mario Bros. Part 2 as well, you find out that the entire adventure that you've been on has just been this dream for Mario, and there's this really, really beautiful little kind of plink-plonk piano song as you just see Mario sleeping and imagining all the characters and monsters that he's visited in the world. And the music was so beautiful that I actually just picked up the rotary phone that we had back then and just dialed a random number. Because no one was in my house at the time, and I just wanted someone to hear how beautiful the music was. And so I just called this random number, and I was playing it to this person at the other end of the line for about, like, 2 minutes. And then at the end of that, I was like, hello? And she was like, who is this? Sure. And I just hung up.
Oh.
Because I didn't actually have anything to say. Like, I was like, I beat Super Mario Brothers. I'm some random Mexican kid.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in those moments, like, you felt as if you had actually kind of completed an adventure or some sort of interactive story. And, you know, I mean, there weren't save functions on consoles back then. It wasn't like you could just conjure up a video of this and share it with someone else. Like, if they weren't around when you beat the game, they weren't going to see it. And they weren't going to see what was at the end of that cartridge. And so it was a very much like, you had to be there. Were you there when he beat that game? Did you see the ending? Have you actually witnessed that thing? And so, yeah, I think in those moments, it was just sort of like, it's kind of like when you finish a book and you just sort of sit back and you're like, wow, like, and you kind of absorb it.
I wonder what that experience was for that random person you called, like what they made of what had just happened to them.
It's a really nice song, man. So, I mean, but back then, telecalls and robocalls weren't really a thing. And so, I mean, I'd like to think that maybe she thought someone gave a crap about her to call her up and play some nice music. But who knows? Maybe she just thought I was a weirdo.
Were there characters that you identified with in those games?
Not really, to be honest. The thing is that all the characters in those games were really, they were kind of brave adventurers. And I mean, I think if anything, maybe one, and I think a lot of people feel like this, even in the current day, because the game has remained in a part of a franchise. But Link from The Legend of Zelda, back when you play a lot of The Legend of Zelda games, there's not necessarily a set course. Like in the first game, you don't really have a direction to go or a set goal or anything. You just kind of pick up a sword and you start running into monsters, and like maybe you'll find the first dungeon you're supposed to go into, maybe not. But, you know, like, these games encourage exploration. And for someone who was raised in the country, like me, and who walked about 30 minutes home from school every day through, like, a series of creeks and railroad tracks and kind of small wooded areas in my neighborhood or whatnot, like, sometimes it did feel adventurous. And I think to kind of get rid of the mundane, you know, you would imagine that you were questing and that the minor things that you found, whether they were just shards of broken glass or old wheat pennies or baby frogs or whatever, were just sort of treasures and kind of special places that no one else really ever knew about. It ended up adding a lot of kind of, I think, rich context and imagination to my childhood that I think otherwise would have been bereft of. I mean, I wasn't into sports as a kid. I didn't really watch a lot of kind of popular television. You know, and so there was something nice to think that kind of in any long stretch home in kind of the hot Texas weather was actually like a small adventure, and that I was kind of, you know, slowly discovering this sort of grander purpose, you know. But as far as thinking that I would ever actually go into a dungeon or slay creatures in Dracula's castle or anything like that, I honestly thought I kind of lacked the fortitude and strength and dexterity to actually do such a thing in real life.
Yeah, it really sounds like, you said that it was Dallas that you're growing up, but it sounds like it was more like the suburban or maybe rural, like outside of Dallas?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, to be clear, I mean, I attended Dallas schools, and after school I would walk to my friend's home. It was about a 30-minute walk every day, but we were living out in the country of a place called Hutchins, Texas, which is about a 20-minute southeast drive from Dallas. My parents and I were basically lying to the school district about where we lived, because schools in the town of Wilmers Hutchins, where we actually lived, were notoriously terrible. I mean, when I was a teenager, like, the town of Wilmer Hutchins had to take over their school district because, like, they were just in such disrepair. And so my parents, both being medical professionals who worked in Dallas, always took us to Dallas schools anyway, just because the level of education was a lot better.
Wow. Did you feel like, I don't know, that must have meant that a lot of your friends were pretty distant from you?
Yeah, you know, but my parents are usually really cool in so far as they would take carloads full of kids back home to where we lived in Wilmer Hutchins, and we had a huge backyard and a big wooded area near my house. And so, you know, these friends would come over for entire weekends, and we would just spend the entire time, like, drinking Coke, raiding the fridge, playing video games, watching movies. My parents would hide out in their bedroom while we basically just took over the house, and these would be, like, groups of, like, 7 or 8 kids simultaneously just, like, crammed into the car and, like, driven out to Wilmer Hutchins. And so, even though we weren't really allowed for most of my school career to participate in extracurricular activities, I still felt pretty close and bonded to my friends because we had long stretches of time together. And I mean, you know, it's kind of like that movie Stand By Me. When you spend that much time with your elementary school friends and the entire world and all the experiences are kind of new and fresh to you, you end up bonding with these people in a way that I just didn't really think was happening with maybe some of my other, with some friends who lived closer into the school district to get to each other.
So how old were you when, you know, this sort of like Stand By Me experience was happening? Was it like in the movie, sort of like on the edge of adolescence?
Yeah, you know, I mean, so this is roughly from, I'd say, ages, 8, 9, all the way until about I entered middle school, so about like 12 or so. So there's about 3 or 4 year span in there where I'm having these sorts of experiences.
It sounds like video games were one of the things that, like, was a shared interest that tied everybody together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in any geek and any fandom will kind of tell you that it gives you a sort of shared cultural reference point and vocabulary, you know, by which to sort of relate to each other. And Yeah, it ended up being kind of a glue that made your friends tolerable for hours and hours on end when otherwise you might just be getting on each other's nerves or fighting.
Did you have stuff that you did, like, outside of video games? I know you mentioned, like, there's sort of, like, exploring the wilderness, so, like, or the out-of-doors. What was fun?
Yeah, you know, that's just it, man. And this was why I was so dorky as a kid, is that, like, that was all I really liked to do. I mean, my parents had to, like, force me out of the house. They would be like, go and play with your brother, you know, and they would make us go, like, you know, I'd bike around with my brother around the neighborhood of Wilmer Hutchins, or we would go exploring in kind of the forest area. But, like, I was one of these kids that was, like, allergic to everything. I mean, allergic to ants and allergic to poison ivy and allergic to grass and allergic to mites. And so it just was such a I was forced to go outdoors. I didn't want to go outdoors. I mean, I'm grateful in retrospect that they forced me to. But if I'd had my druthers, man, I just would have been inside playing video games nonstop.
It sounds like you were, like, a really, like, physically vulnerable child.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's just it, especially in Texas where football is king. You know, you're supposed to be this kind of rough and tumble kid. And so the idea that you had this, like, sensitive kid who liked, you know, the poetry of, say, Shel Silverstein, occasional Disney movies, I felt quite delicate and sort of underexposed to a lot of my kind of rough and tumble, presumably heterosexual peers. I just wasn't into it. I wasn't into wrestling games. Yeah, I mean, you know, like, fighting on the schoolyard, or, like, you know, teasing each other, and, like, you know, like, I hated field day. I couldn't catch or throw. I still can't catch or throw. And so I just felt like a bookish nerd. I mean, at the time, I at least felt like my intellect could kind of allow me to kind of quickly retort if I needed to defend myself, and I could run pretty fast. And so, like, that felt like if I ever really got into a scrap, which never happened, that I would be okay. But beyond that, I was very much like, oh, I hope I never get into, like, an actual schoolyard fight, or I hope that, like, I'm never called on to be, like, part of, like, a football or soccer team, because I was just like, my childhood asthma will kick in, and, like, it'll just be like, I'll be like Piggy on freaking Lord of the Flies.
How did that go? Were you able to evade attention pretty much?
Childhood asthma was a blessing in that regards, because it gave me a sort of perpetual out for any sort of physical activity where I'd be like, ooh, can't do the running today. Childhood asthma. That helped. I spent a lot of the time that I was supposed to be, like, in the schoolyard after lunch or during recess, I would just sneak off to the library, because as long as you were there when the bell rang, no one really cared. And so, you know, I mean, and I eventually forged a small group of friends. You know, we kind of had this ongoing weird tag game where we had sort of these moon type space invaders versus like humans that were trying to hold on. It was very like V and meets Alien Nation type, you know, thing. And so, you know, we ended up kind of creating a game that was more just about tag and about the story rather than it was about like catching or throwing or like beating someone up or, you know, anything like that. And so, you know, I was able to, I think, get that the older I got, but when I kind of started out as a younger third, fourth and fifth grader, I felt really kind of subject to any sort of physicality and really just adverse to it.
It really sounds like inserting adventure into the world was a big thing for you, like whether it's video games where you're like going out on these adventures where you're not actually allergic to stuff or.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I think that's kind of continued to my present day. I mean, I sort of have a life philosophy that if you kind of can't make it fun, then it's pretty much a drag. And I kind of have to seriously question like if it's worth doing. I mean, you know, we all have a certain amount of adulting, but I think I still like to think or believe that I and a lot of my contemporaries have some sort of higher purpose that is beyond just waking up to work, pay bills, and then die. You know, I like to think that we're kind of cultivating and preparing ourselves for usefulness or for some sort of quest or journey in some sort of other grand narrative kind of way. And that may be a complete delusion. That may just be something I kind of tell myself to help make, you know, the dystopic capitalist corporatist hellscape that we live in a bit more bearable, but it's a damn good delusion, I think, you know, and you get a lot of mileage and fuel and a lot of creative self-expression out of it, I think. So
where did that start? Like, when did you realize that that was something you could do, like prepare yourself for some larger purpose? Like, what larger purposes did you prepare yourself for?
You know, so when I started out younger, I used to go to church back in the day. My mom was raised Pentecostal. My dad was atheist. And so the compromise was that we would go to, you know, Baptist churches that were seemingly respectable, at least in outward appearance. And, you know, when I was young and I had first learned about Christianity, I was just like, oh, cool, there's this worldwide organization that their entire purpose is just to be nice to each other and just to help other people out. And I was like, that's so cool. Like, that's like, I'm a nice person and I like helping people. Like, it's so good that there's people in the world that literally just do that. And of course, as I got older, I realized it was like, it actually comes with a lot of strings attached, and they also hate you because, you know, you like dudes. And so that kind of obliterated my purpose. I think somewhere around age 12 or 13, you know, I realized that both my heavenly father and my biological one didn't really like me very much. Around that time, kind of, my dad became physically abusive to me. He had been abusive to my sister in the past. And so that kind of combined with a loss of faith was really destabilizing, because a lot of my own journey or worth or identity were kind of really centered around, you know, giving worship and praise, you know, making macaroni pictures and singing in the choir, learning Bible stories, you know, in my church. And then also, you know, just kind of having academic achievements for my father who, you know, otherwise, oh goodness, now my dog is starting up. To be honest, I don't really feel like I kind of reestablished a purpose for myself. Maybe until sometime, by college. I mean,
so what was that? Like, how did that actually happen? What was the purpose?
Well, you know, so, I think the struggle from the time that, you know, I kind of lost my faith in my dad and God, and the time between that and the time that I feel like I kind of refound some sort of sense of purpose was me mostly just coming to terms with my sexuality. You know, I mean, I was raised during the, you know, HIV epidemic, and my mom was listening to a lot of conservative Christian radio that basically said that anything cool from video games to books, Ghostbusters, the movie Dracula, you know, Castlevania, that it was all basically derived from Satan. I mean, you have a different sort of sexual vampirism in the movie Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I was exposed to at probably way too early an age. Like, I saw that film when I was like around 12. And, you know, I mean, I was basically taught that anything cool was satanic. And therefore, you know, I was kind of evil, inherently evil and wrong for even being interested in those sorts of things. And while I think some people hear that and they're like, yeah, I'm satanic, I didn't want to be satanic. Like, I liked being like a good Christian boy, and I liked the idea that I was going to heaven and that like God liked me. And so I don't think it was until I finally came to terms with the idea that, you know, contemporary institutionalized, you know, religion as I had experienced it was a complete sham, and a form of spiritual abuse. So it wasn't until I had actually kind of come out and, you know, had accepted that there was nothing wrong with me being like that, and there was, in that I was able to enjoy the company of my boyfriends, and that I was still a really, really great person, in fact even better than I thought I was in college. I don't know, I just decided that I wanted to do my best to kind of educate and make the world a better place. And I know that sounds really, really cliche, but you know, when I first went into college, I was interested in doing an advertising major. And then the longer I was there, I was like, advertising is doing a good enough job preying off of people's insecurities without my input. I got involved with the community service station there at Austin College, where I went to school. And I became a resident assistant, and I joined a fraternity that had a bit of kind of social, you know, social community service in it. And so at that
point... Why did you initially want to do advertising?
I was encouraged by a journalism professor. We had a really great award-winning high school program that I was involved with for 4 years. It was like kind of nationally award-winning and really, really tough, like basically like a part-time job. And the journalism advisor who was, you know, head of that program at our school, the faculty advisor, was basically like, hey, you have a twisted sense of humor, and I think that you could actually make a lot of money in advertising. And so... During my time there, you know, he took me to, I think, the William Morris Advertising Agency when we had a convention in Chicago, and he had sort of someone who worked there kind of show us around. And so I was like, oh, cool, you can just kind of make jokes and make funny commercials and advertisements and, you know, and just make a pretty good living just sort of being a weird, you know, kind of spunky, creative guy. And so that kind of drew me to it, I think, initially. But as that started to change, and I kind of realized that, you know, a lot of corporate actors didn't really have their scruples, it just kind of changed. And so I ended up majoring in English and psychology. And I can't say that I exactly knew what I wanted to do with it at the time, but I did believe in the idea that, and I still do believe in the idea that psychology can create immense healing in people. And having been encouraged to write since I was a very young person as well. I mean, we didn't even talk about this in terms of media, but I was writing, you know, kind of short stories and kind of small, you know, fantasies and whatnot as a kid, just, you know, me and my friends going on adventures and kind of make-believe places like crystal castles or like lands of geometry or whatever. And so I just kind of realized that I could wield my writing as a power and influence people's mood and give them insights and educate them and challenge them and make them feel and question in certain ways. And so I hadn't yet figured out what I was going to do, but I knew that I wanted to seriously foster my writing and do what I could to make that sort of a world-changing life form, if just for a small group of readers, if not the world.
Was there something like that happened to, you know, I'm sure like it wasn't like a sudden thing to decide to move out of advertising and into something else, but was there like a breakup or something that like was a hard cutoff from one track and onto another?
You know, I think that I just started, I was reading a lot of, I think the magazine was called Adbusters. I don't know if it's still around. And there were a couple of books, you know, that just got me in a sort of, I think, revolutionary spirit. I mean, when you read Adbusters and you just learn a lot about kind of the environmental degradation and like the sweatshop labor and, you know, the eating disorders and everything just kind of created by the constant churn of insecurity that is advertising, I was just like, ugh, like that sounds evil. It sounds actually evil. And so I think that that's what it was. And it didn't happen all at once. I think it just kind of gradually over time, I just kind of got this really sort of dystopic worldview of what advertising and consumerism was really doing to people. And I think it went hand in hand with my own exposure to the music of Radiohead. Yeah, I mean, if you listen to OK Computer, you know, or look at the artwork done by Tom York and Stanley Donwood, who's a UK-based visual artist and kind of horror writer in his own right, you just see these places where every place looks exactly the same and nowhere is home, and that everyone's completely alienated and are just kind of drilling holes in themselves just to feel things, and everyone's kind of secretly crawling up the walls, and like nothing makes any sense, and there's just this sort of perpetual war and isolation and coldness. And so I think those messages really started to kind of seep into my consciousness, and I really just started to kind of be like, ugh, we live in a really broken place, and like I don't want to contribute to its brokenness anymore. And I don't think that there was this one moment where I was like, aha, I'm not going to do it. Because my degree was always going to be in English and psychology. I just thought that that was going to be a good mix for me to learn how to, you know, persuade people through advertising. It's just that as I kind of came to that realization, I decided that advertising wasn't really something that I wanted to contribute to. And it just happened over the course of years, I think.
So where did you go from there? I know you got into journalism, but like, what was that? Or I guess back into journalism, because it was something that you'd been doing in high school. So what, like, were there, I don't know, things that made you feel like, okay, this was the right place for me to be?
So it didn't happen all at once. I mean, I did journalism in high school, and I was, you know, the kind of the features editor, and it did kind of, you know, human interest stories. I was sort of a personal column writer. And I did a tiny bit of art design stuff for our newspaper in college, but that was only for 1 year because our newspaper there wasn't nearly as good as our high school newspaper. It wasn't really until I went to graduate school at Columbia University in New York City that I kind of got back on the journalism beat. When I was there, I was not only taking a lot of nonfiction classes because I felt like I wanted to not only, you know, learn kind of the literary methods of fiction, but I wanted to learn how to employ those towards telling my own lifehood stories and my own, you know, and telling other kind of incredible nonfiction stories. When I was there, I headed up a group called the Comedy Writers Lunch, which the entire conceit of the group was just that we would bring in comedians from around New York City to kind of come and talk to our students while we provided a lunch to our students. And so, you know, I talked to John Oliver and Aziz Ansari and there are a handful of others. I'm kind of blanking out right now. I got a chance to interview them, and we ran a website, and we had, you know, and so I started doing kind of posts and things like that. And then around my, I think it was my second year in grad school, Queerdy.com, which is a website that I still occasionally write for, they had this contest that was like, hey, come be our next music reviewer. And I really liked Queerdy back at the time. Back at the time, Queerdy was sort of a heck of a lot snarkier. And like, I mean, this was kind of at the advent of like blogging, like back when, like, you know, Drudge Report and Gawker, like it was sort of the age of Gawker, right? And so, I mean, like there was a really high premium on like being a sort of, you know, gotcha, more clever than thou, snarky, in the know, worldly writer. And Queerdy was very much kind of that vibe. It was like a little bit gonzo, but like very like, oh yeah, we're smarter than the average gay. And so I was like, oh God, being like their music reviewer would like be so great. Like it'd be like a great foot in the door. So, you know, I competed for it, and, you know, I got it. From then I kind of just started regularly writing for Queerdy. I mean, eventually once they realized kind of how into music reviews I was, cause I would, you know, play the albums like until my ears bled, and like I would write these really literary reviews using like this, you know, Ivy League education that was like, you know, right next to stories about guys taking off their shirts. And I was into it. I was super into it. And so once they saw I had that kind of devotion, they were like, hey, you know, do you want to actually do some news reporting and, you know, some kind of political reporting? And so before too long, I kind of ended up becoming a regular contributor for them. And that was kind of my foray back into, you know, journalism. Although at the time I considered it more kind of blogging because it was sort of fast and loose journalism where you weren't always doing interviews and a lot of the research was web research and, you know, the tools and methods had changed a lot from what I had learned back when I was in high school where we didn't really have the internet.
What were you doing, like, as you're doing this, like, writing that you're really passionate about and listening to music and stuff like that, was that like a side hustle while you had another day job?
I took out way too many student loans at Columbia. Like, I learned everything about money management from like stealing from the Monopoly bank when I played Monopoly like as kids. And so like when they were like, how much money do you want to take out? I was like, the limit. How much can I take out? Let's do it. Just thinking like, what do I care? I'm just going to die one day. It's just, this is numbers. This is electronic numbers. I regret that thinking immensely now. But,
sure.
So I did have a part-time job doing, you know, some online work for a print company that I worked in Dallas before I went to grad school. But beyond that, I mean, it was mostly that I was just, you know, burning through student loan money, and kind of doing this on the side. And back when I first started working for Queerty, like, I don't even know that they were paying, to be honest. I think at first, like, I can't remember if they were or not, but like, you know, if they were, it was a pittance. Like, I can't imagine that it was more than like 15, maybe like $20 a story, if that. Not that the market for journalism has improved drastically since that time. It hasn't really.
What did you see as like the future for that? Like, where did you want to be?
You know, at the time, before I really realized what a sort of uptight prig Andrew Sullivan was, I really admired, he had something called the Daily Dish, and it was just him kind of churning out his thoughts on, you know, any given topic of the day. And he had such a kind of a great variety and breadth of things that he was covering that I was like, that's cool. I want to be someone who's just a kind of notable man about town, who's, you know, kind of an authority on, you know, all manner of things from, you know, marijuana, like pornography, and like, you know, subversive, like queer punk culture, and like art film, and, you know, you name it. And so I told my mom at one point, I was like, I don't want readers. I want disciples. Like, I want like people who are like, holy shit, that guy is so cool. And like, I can't wait to see what he does next. You know, I mean, when you're writing journalism in a print medium, at least back in the day, you know, before the days of email and social media, you might get like a student being like, oh yeah, I read your article. If they even knew who you were and bothered to locate you on campus and like just happened to like, or you would get a teacher to be like, oh, I really liked that feature. But that was like once a year. And so, you know, you felt really quite distant where you're just like, I'm just putting these things out there. And like, I guess people might be reading them, but I don't think they're of any consequence. But, you know, when I actually started writing for Queerty, and you could actually see how many people were logging in and reading the story, how many people were leaving comments, you could actually engage with people in the comments, I was like, this has a very immediate impact. And it ends up becoming a high. I mean, I think as someone who works in journalism as well, Matt, I mean, you kind of know that there can be this weird sort of dopamine rush to seeing, you know, how much your story has been shared and who's talking about it, and if, you know, anyone famous has shared it, or, you know, if any influencers have. And
do you
so,
have any writing that you're particularly like proud of?
Oh, hell yeah. A couple of years ago, I wrote this really long, I don't know if I would call it expose, but it was about the whole noodles and beef thing, which I guess for your readers who might be lucky enough not to know what that is, there was basically this kind of polyamorous pack of man pups. Noodles and Beef was sort of an Instagram whore of sorts who would, you know, take him and his polyamorous man pups were all kind of these muscle pups who they would take pictures of themselves at like Folsom Street Fair or at like different circuit parties wearing like their harnesses and like their little thongs with like the big muscles and their big, you know, like they're, you know, and just making those dumb bear face expressions with like their tongue sticking out of the sides and showing how amazing their life is and talking about their proteins and their workouts and their diets and like all the stupid crap. And I never really paid much attention to any of that.
Yeah, I can tell you're not a fan.
Well, you know, it just I mean, for those who like, I mean, you know, I like a good thirst pick as much as the next guy. And for those who want to and make their time, you know, doing it, cool, man. More power to you. And I might even be watching and enjoying some of your stuff.
Well, you say like cool, man, but your tone is like, it's clear how you feel about them.
Yeah, I mean, well, so you know, let's be clear, is that my disdain in this particular case, I think, there ends up being this sort of showy peacocking of a sort of new queer masculinity that I find really kind of confining, and I do think kind of contributes to this sort of, like, look at me exclusivity that kind of pervades our community. I mean, if you look at advertising around, you know, gay bars and circuit parties and, you know, cruise lines or whatnot, like, it continues to be this sort of, you know, like, sexy come hither muscle daddy, you know, it's kind of regurgitated and given to us ad infinitum. And it's boring and it's gross. It's a type of conformity that's like blah. And so, I mean, like, you know, I mean, like, I would like to think that I'm a very live and let live kind of person. And if someone wants to devote their time towards that and they enjoy it and, you know, you're not hurting anyone, like, cool, man, go for it. I'm just saying it's not for me. I mean, I'd say I feel the same way about those, about people who are into that as I do with people who are super duper into football. Like, great, there's nothing wrong with football per se. I just am super duper not into it.
Sure. I guess I understand being... I guess annoyed by the images that perpetuate body dysmorphia and, you know, the lack of diversity that you often see in queer media. Like, I do think that is a problem, and it grosses me out too, that the, you know, something that I like about living in Seattle is that it has been, especially after coming from Los Angeles, a city that is a lot more body positive. Mm. And so I love that. And it is kind of exhausting to see the, you know, the complexes that people can develop when they see, like, there's one physical way to be gay. I do think that that's harmful. I don't begrudge people who have muscles, but
no, not at all.
Presenting that as, like, the right way to be gay is, like, that's a problem.
Well, I mean, I think that's it. So I had a friend ask me a couple years ago in San Francisco. He was like, what does it mean to be homosexual without the sex? Like, you know, what are we really left with? And I was like, are you kidding? I was like,
yeah, geez, that's what this whole show's about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, precisely. And that's basically what I told to him. But, you know, beyond kind of the aesthetics and all of that and kind of connecting through sort of, you know, vulnerability and kind of performance and all of that, I was like, there is a genuine history of kind of camaraderie, subtext, protecting one another, comforting, healing, being spiritual guides, and other things that I think really, really get lost when you're like, come back to the vodka speedo jockey blowout, do a bunch of cocaine and meth, and then have an orgy. And it's like, okay, cool, yeah, fine. Like, okay for a weekend, but, like, that isn't my culture. It's not a culture that I think is healthy for anyone to be in 24/7. And I think we have so much more.
You don't think the cocaine and meth is not healthy?
You know, I mean, to get back to the noodles and beef thing, I mean, so the part of the story, and I think shows kind of the excesses of why that's unhealthy, is that these guys were doing really dangerous body modification things on each other by basically injecting liquid silicone into their testicles. And, you know, to kind of achieve this sort of cartoon bull sort of furry body aesthetic that, you know, is just, you know, big cojones. One of the polyamorous man pups ended up dying because some silicone got into his bloodstream and it gave him a pulmonary embolism and he died. And so this noodles and beef character ended up you know, kind of hiding the guy's death and hid a lot of their traces of their relationship by completely wiping out his deceased partner's Tumblr account. And so, you know, in that specific case, and the reason I was proud of that story is I initially took it on for kind of a weird fascination because there were so many parts of the story that were just totally bonkers. But over time, I like, as I began to hear from the mother of the deceased, I was like, wow, this was actually a real person. And he worked for HIV charities. And from what I saw of his life online, he was a really, really nice, sweet dude who was in an incredibly abusive relationship by, like, a controlling, dishonest megalomaniac. And, like, that's gross. And I want people to know Dylan Heffernan's name for, like, the rest of his life, to know that, like, he negatively influenced and, like, and treated this guy who he purportedly loved like complete dog shit. Because what is that? And so I just mean to say is that I think that, you know, when you kind of saturate in this sort of toxic, you know, culture that's completely about appearances and how well you can maintain this sort of BDSM cred, and that if you lose your humanity in that, and you lose your compassion, and you lose the fact that you're actually dealing with real people with souls and their consequences, you kind of become a demon in my head.
Sure.
You know, and I know that's really harsh.
So, you know, you're writing about this one particular guy, but it sounds like there's something larger going on here, which is that, you know, he's just one person. There's only so many people one person can hurt. But it sounds like there's a principle that you're writing about here, which is, I guess, moral imperative of calling out abusive behavior.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and I want to be clear is that, like, a value that I have in my writing, because I do see myself primarily as an educator. I mean, I think that my writing should always be clear and and engaging and conversational and educational, because something my father told me from a very young age is that everyone likes to learn, whether they like to or not. If you want to give a good speech, you want to give a good piece of writing, whatever, like teach people something, and make it engaging, make it speak to a real world thing that they need to learn how to do. Even in the piece that I wrote about Dylan Hafferty-Pinn, it wasn't just about like, this guy's a sleaze, what a jerk. But it was also educating people about like, hey, this is what these are some of the realities of BDSM culture. And by some of the realities, I don't mean like it's abusive and crappy. Actually, not at all. I took great pains in that article to actually be like, look, this is not indicative of the pup play community. This is not indicative of necessarily the body modification community or the BDSM community. This is taken to an extreme that actually those communities find really toxic and really problematic. And so in those pieces, like I wanted to be like, there are a lot of really wonderful things about the imagination and freedom and camaraderie that come through pup play. There's a lot of really cool, neat, self-expressive and self-determining things about body modification. There's so many positive, cool, wonderful, subversive things about BDSM relationships that really get people to open up to themselves and to communities and to let go of body shame and slut shame and kind of our puritanical cultural strictures that I'm like, fantastic. Let's show people those possibilities. Let's show, like, so what I'm trying to say, Matt, is for me, it's not just about kind of calling out bad behavior and being like, this thing sucks. Get him. Get the monster. Burn the witch. It's really, I like trying to create pieces as well, if possible, in the same piece to be like, there's an alternative way to be. You don't just have to buy into this one BS story about like this is the end all be all. I mean, right now in the midst of coronavirus, you have all these people who are like, let's get back to normal, and like all of these white normies who are like, let me go to work so I can die. And like, I'm just like, have you people never thought to fight for, I don't know, socialized health care, a fair wage? A world where we don't just go to work and die, where it's not just about paying bills and being slave to some sort of machine. Like, can you have some sort of imagination of a different kind of society that just works and acts and interacts with each other completely differently? And a lot of people are like, oh, I hate those protesters or whatever. And like, I think two things is one, we know they're somewhat astroturfed. Two, we th I can understand why they want just to feel like things are normal. The lockdown is really, really confining and is exacerbating mental health issues. And for people who don't have jobs or can't get financial assistance or unemployment or anything like right now, mega super duper extra fucking stressful. And yet I kind of so I think that there are good reasons that some people are trying to reopen their states and their cities, and I can understand why someone wants to go get a haircut or have Mexican food and just feel normal. And yet I pity these protesters because I'm like, you're really just fighting to go back into the world where nothing has changed and that the plutocracy that's running our government like doesn't give a shit about you. Why do you want that world back? It makes me pity them because I'm like, you suffer from a severe lack of imagination and like, and it doesn't have to be that way. I know you're scared and I know that like things are really screwed up right now and that you just want it to go back to normal, but like, can we talk? Like, can we dream and like create something new? And a lot of people don't really have the ability, I think, to withstand the discomfort and the work that's really required for that sort of change.
When you were writing about the whole Dylan situation, and if this is too personal, we don't have
No,
to go
go
here,
ahead.
but to what extent, if at all, were you thinking about the experience that you had yourself with the situation you survived with your father?
How much was I thinking about kind of the abuse and like the way that it played into it? I can't say that there was a conscious thing at the time. I will say that about 2 years after I wrote the piece, I began to think a lot more about how abuse had kind of functioned in my life. So, I was sort of a serial monogamist at the time, and I was with my most recent ex when I was writing that piece. He was really supportive and really, really great. And the editor at the Seattle Stranger, Christopher Frizzell, was really amazing during the entire thing, a real kind of advocate who I felt was in the trenches with me. But after I ended up breaking up out of that relationship, I had had the same sort of relationship almost like 3 or 4 times in a row. And I was just like, what is, it was like a Groundhog's Day. And I was just like, what is it? Like, what is going, how do I end up in these relationships with conservative guys who at first seem like really, really chill and easygoing, and they end up most certainly not chill and not easygoing. And they end up kind of resenting me for, you know, sort of, you know, just being very self-involved and whatever. And so some of it was my stuff, but I was just like, what's going on? I read this really amazing book called From Surviving to Thriving by Pete Walker, that goes into the complexities of something called complex PTSD, which basically just says that when most people are young, they end up being emotionally abandoned by the adults in their lives. And for queer people, one of the ways that emotional abandonment ends up manifesting is through the constant, you know, stigma and reinforcement that you are not okay, and that your very desires and intuition are meant to be distrusted because they're disgusting and against God and potentially pedophilic and just all these other negative things that we're saddled with as young people. And so it really divorces you from your own joy, your own divinity, your own sense of self. And I kind of realized the ways that my father's abuse really contributed to that. In my house, you were basically allowed to express academic excellence in the form of a report card, or to be sad when the abuse was happening. But otherwise, you weren't really, you kept your mouth shut, man. And you didn't say or do anything because you didn't want to be noticed by your own father. And I didn't realize that apart from, you know, like I became really, really bad at telling people bad news because you tell your dad bad news, you get smacked. But I also didn't end up telling him about anything good going on in my life. During that time, I would concentrate focus. I would focus on the things that I wasn't good at. So, you know, like calculus and chemistry, you know, things that are so incredibly useless in my own personal life. I mean, I'm glad we have experts who are good at them, who can, you know, help make cars that don't crash and medicines that work. But, you know, in my own life, like, that doesn't help me do a lick of work. And I was constantly kind of taught by my dad's abuse that it was like, hey, Daniel, you need to spend your life focusing on the things that you are not good at, because that's going to get your ass beat. And it wasn't until I kind of started doing a lot of self-work and kind of trauma recovery in a very focused way, I'd say just about a year and a half ago, that I sort of realized the millions of ways that the abuse kind of emotionally stunted me. And the fact that my divinity, my spark, my joy de vivre actually has to do with me being able to express and explore the things that I'm really, really curious about. And it's too bad that my dad didn't really have the wherewithal, time, or patience to know that his son was a budding, queer, theatric, expressive, curious dude. He just saw me as, I think, kind of a little grade machine. At least that's the way it felt like he treated me. And it's become so much more important in this phase of my life, especially now at age 40. I'd say I'm probably, by most conservative estimates, halfway through my entire lifespan, to really reclaim and to really explore and get into that. I mean, to get more in touch with myself and my own creative side, because I didn't realize the ways that his abuse really divorced me from all of that.
What does trauma recovery look like?
So in the context of this book, and what's been really useful to me is there are primarily two models. One involves going back and thinking about the formative aspects of trauma that really kind of shaped your worldview. So in my case, my dad was only ever physically abusive, maybe like about five times, very specific incidents. And I know everyone's life is like that, but you're supposed to kind of think of the more formative incidents and then do what they call time traveling or reparenting. The idea is that you go back there as your current adult self, kind of a ghost, and you witness the events. You try to remember them as vividly as possible, you know, the all five senses, what was going on, what was said, what it was like, what you were feeling, all that. And then you're encouraged to talk to each and every person involved in that scenario. So in this case, you know, I was like, you know, grabbing my dad by the throat and being like, keep your hands off that fucking kid, you know, I fucking kick your ass, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, and I was embracing, you know, my kind of younger self and being like, hey, like, I know things are really, really hard, and, you know, you don't deserve this, and like, life isn't always going to be this way, and you're actually like a really strong, good kid. And so the idea is that you finally start to basically work through grief and anger that you weren't really allowed to express at the present moment. I think a lot of people end up having these sort of adverse childhood experiences, and they just sort of bottle them up, and they don't really know how to process them, because American society has no sort of psychological literacy. We're not taught, about self-soothing or healing, or, you know, I mean, psychiatry is still treated like as some sort of arcane, you know, anti-Christian knowledge sometimes, like kind of like yoga is treated sometimes. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is something called internal family systems, or IFS. And what that is we all have this sort of critical, this inner critic in our head that, you know, kind of usually, you know, puts you down or gets on you for not doing things the way you want to. And then usually to compensate for how bad that makes us feel, we will end up kind of, the pendulum will swing the other way, and you'll be like, you know, we try to cope by numbing ourselves through, you know, alcohol or drugs or sex or socializing or distractions, or, you know, people will normally find some way to fight or flee or fawn, which means to make yourself more kind of helpful to your abusers. Or you freeze, you just completely disassociate and kind of shut out from everyone. And what IFS says is that you're supposed to kind of go into your psyche, and instead of telling your inner critic and your, you know, what they call firemen, but the people who are doing these overcompensatory, numbing behaviors, instead of seeing those as your enemies or your bad parts, you're supposed to kind of compassionately accept them and just get into conversation with them and just be like, what is it? Like, how old do you think I am? And what are you trying to do? Like, what do you think your job is in my psyche? And do you think it's going successfully, what you're doing? Would you rather be doing something else? How could we kind of work together better? And in IFS, you have to basically kind of go back and meditate and do these sorts of things over and over and over again until you kind of start to make peace with parts of yourself that have probably been at conflict for a really long time. But what I really like about IFS is that they say that the person having these conversations, kind of yourself, are defined by a bunch of C words. And so you know if you're behaving like yourself, if you are compassionate, creative, curious, courageous. There are a bunch of other ones. You'd have to look it up. But the idea that there's this kind of mode of being that you can sort of trust, that remind you when you're really in possession of yourself and when you're not encumbered by the inner critical voices or by the overcompensatory behaviors, but that you're actually like, no, I'm possessed of self, and this is actually what it feels like to be me. It was something that I'd never really had a framework for healing before. I think before people had always told me, oh, fake it till you make it. If you just fake your way and pretend like you have confidence, one day you'll look back and you'll see all the things you've accomplished and you will have confidence. And that never happened for me, Matt. I looked back after a career about 10 or 15 years and I just felt like a really accomplished fake. And so no one gave me these skills. These skills aren't taught in schools. No one taught me what I needed to know. And so a big part of my life right now has been trying to educate other people about these things, because you look around to a lot of queer people and just a lot of people in the world, and they need this sort of healing. I really wish this was taught in schools. I really wish kids were taught to meditate and taught like about interpersonal dynamics and coping mechanisms and things like that, because like we're in the midst of a mental health epidemic. And if you look at why we live in such a dystopic hellscape, I think that's part of it.
A lot of what you're describing sounds like there are potential pitfalls of just getting kind of stuck in the past, or dealing with, maybe not dealing with, but focusing on regrets and things like, I wish I could have done this differently, or I wish I'd known, or I wish I'd said. Like, how do you move past stuff? Like,
yeah.
Once you're reliving it, how do you close the door on it?
Yeah, warning, kids, do not try this alone at home. You works best, of course, if you are doing this in tandem with a trained psychotherapist who is actually into it. And for queer people, find yourself a queer one, god damn it. That way you can avoid all the judginess. But no, Matt, I wouldn't recommend anyone just go and do these things without having some sort of professionally trained psychological support, and maybe even, you know, accompanying medication if you need it. Just because you're right, I think if people try to kind of just navigate this on their own, there's some good starting things that may get you off the right path, but it can be incredibly hard. There were times that I felt severely depressed, and that I was just like, oh wow, I'm a real piece of crap. I don't even know why I'm here. And so, but that's the answer. Is I think my therapist was really, really good about, whenever I started to get mired into those places, to redirect my energy or my attention to the fact that it's like, hey, Daniel, but these are the positive things that are currently happening. This is the big picture of the progress we're making. These are the inroads that we're making. Here are the ways that you're changing that you weren't able to do when we first started to see each other. Having someone to remind you and to kind of draw you back and to help kind of ground you into the world of like the positive and like the growth that you're actually doing is absolutely essential, because you're right. Otherwise, it can be really easy to get mired and to lose sight and to maybe even spiral to a place that's pretty difficult to get out of.
Okay, so this is not a DIY project.
No, not at all. But I do recommend those books as kind of a good start, or that book as a good starting point. But if you're going to really undertake the work, absolutely get a therapist, a really good one.
Are there elements that you look back on from your life and you're like, oh, actually, that was good. That was just like, that doesn't need work or processing. I could just look back and reflect on that and remember it and feel happy about it.
You know, I mean, my grad school years, I became an outright slut in New York City. You know, it was my first time living outside of Texas, and it was my first time. I was recently broken up from a relationship, and I admittedly spent a lot more time kind of slutting around than I did really spending refining my writing. And, you know, I'd say there are even times right now where I still kind of regret it, because I'm like, oh, you had like these 2 years where you were just encouraged to read and write as much as possible. And like, I spent most of the time, you know, just like cruising.
You wasted your time living.
I mean, yeah, but you know, I mean, but there was a kind of almost a sex addicty thing where if you're using it to kind of numb yourself against the sort of internal emotional pain that you feel, and you know that you're not necessarily doing the writing that you ostensibly went out there for. So I felt conflicted, because on one hand, I was like, cool, this is the queer cultural education I never got in Dallas. But on the other hand, it was like, I felt like I was compulsively sleeping with guys. Like I kind of couldn't not.
Yeah, that's not great.
Yeah. And so when I look back in that period now, I have a lot of compassion actually for that younger self, where it was like, Daniel, you were making up for lost time of you were trying to get as much of the queer world into you as into me as possible.
Sure.
You know, I mean, so first off, I not only ended up making a lot of really excellent, influential, incredibly positive friends that I still go out and see there, who have had an immense, who immensely changed the way that I see my life and cultural heritage as a queer man. And I wouldn't trade that for the world. And I think, and also in retrospect, I'm kind of like, Daniel, you needed to go through that period. You're in your early 20s and you had done absolutely no trauma processing whatsoever. You had never been comforted for all of the abuses that you had endured. Of course, you were looking for validation and affirmation and physical touch and like the arms of like other men and like a community. Like that's okay, man. Like you were hurting. I love you. Like you needed that. It's really okay.
Wow. There's a lot of like monologuing that it seems like you do now, like a lot of conversation that you have with yourself.
I talk to myself all the time.
Has that always been a thing for you?
Yeah, my mom told me it was a sign of intelligence. Maybe it's just a mom thing moms say. But you know, I mean, I've had to prop myself up a lot, man. I mean, when our community or our society doesn't really support artists. Artists are largely kind of have to go it alone. I mean, even you find people who support you, they're not necessarily there when you're alone and doing the work. And so I think that because I grew up with a lot of kind of negative self-talk, it's taken a lot of, you know, reparenting, affirmations, and kind of pumping myself up and really talking through things that like other people, as well-intentioned and as supportive they are, like, they don't know what it's like to be in your head. They don't know what it's like to do the work when you're completely on your own. And I've really had to pep myself up and kind of help redirect and reassure myself that shit was going to be okay, because for a long time, those weren't the messages I was giving myself.
Is that something you feel now, that it is going to be okay?
I mean, for me, yeah. I think for me, life is going to be fine. I mean, I think no matter what happens, I'm getting closer in touch with, you know, kind of my creative impulses. And I honestly think that it's only going to continue to improve as I understand more and more of what I need and what I want. And I don't look to a compulsive partnering, romantic partnerships to achieve that, but that I kind of continue to have a love affair with myself. The rest of the world's probably going to hell in a handbasket, to be quite honest. I don't really have a lot of optimism about that.
Now that you're feeling better about yourself and your ability to, you know, handle the world and, you know, whatever kind of condition it's going to be in, what has that allowed you to do now? Like what can you do now that you're excited to get underway that you might not have done or might not have been successful at in the past?
Yeah. So something I'm dabbling with right now, and it sounds kind of silly, but I really love it, is I got a bunch of body paint markers so I could start like marking on like my arms and face before I go out. It's not exactly makeup because I'm not trying to look like a pretty man or like a drag queen or anything. They're just like, I think I call it a sort of urban, like looking like an urban native. I mean, if maybe like some of the face paint that you might have seen in like, say, the Lost Boys of Hook or something like that. But I just am like, cool, I would like to go out and I would like my face and my body to reflect how I feel inside with something that's not nearly as permanent or consequential as a tattoo that I might regret in later years. Concomitant with that, I have begun becoming more interested in fashion. And so I've put together kind of a small bit of a flannel capes and kind of weird like cuffs and just weird kind of clothing accents that are just sort of like, I want to go out and look a little weird. I want people to kind of be like, what is that guy's deal? And that for my external appearance to reflect a lot more of kind of my playful nature on the inside. I don't think I would have had a lot of courage to really kind of go out and do that when I was younger, because I was, even just a couple of years ago, because I was so afraid of being seen and sort of being derided and maybe targeted for being different. But now that I'm getting older, I'm like, cool, you want to paint your face, man? Paint your face. Go out. You know, I've been working from home for the last 10 years, so I don't have coworkers or, like, management who are going to be like, who the hell is a guy with a face paint on? Like, tell him to wipe that shit up. Like, I don't live in that world. I don't really want to live in that world. You know, if I had to, I would go back and, you sure, I wouldn't wear face paint to work. But I just mean to say is that, like, the idea that I can express myself out of work, you know, in those sorts of ways where it's sort of like, oh, cool, local eccentric. I think the more that I externalize that, the more that I'll kind of remind myself, like, Daniel, you can be as weird as you'd like to. You can, you know, you can live your life and do pretty much whatever it is you would really, really like to do.
Well, that sounds great. Daniel, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Matt.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Daniel for joining me. There's a time limit on my recommendation this week. For this weekend only, June 12th through June 14th, 2020, you can watch the 2015 NBC special The Wiz Live for free on YouTube. It's part of Andrew Lloyd Webber's series of stage-to-screen broadcasts, and yes, I know The Wiz isn't an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, but somehow, through some corporate maze, he's able to bring NBC's live musical library to YouTube right now. So, okay. There have been approximately 3 billion other adaptations of The Wizard of Oz, and this one might actually be one of the best. The cast is fantastic, the Cirque du Soleil dancers bring pizzazz, and Harvey Fierstein's teleplay fixes a lot of the problems from the original text. Dorothy's choice to leave Oz actually makes sense in this one. There's bright colors everywhere, huge energy and enthusiasm, and the streamlining of some of the repetitive songs make this version a stupendous blast to watch. And the cast is incredible. Amber Riley from Glee, Mary J. Blige as the Wicked Witch, Queen Latifah, David Alan Grier, Common, Neo, it's perfect. Previous live musicals were saddled with celebrity stunt casting, but this one just cast great performers who can kill it in their roles. Obviously, this weekend is going to be busy with more protesting and political action, and your schedule is likely already filled with activities that seem far more important than sitting down to watch a musical on YouTube. But when you get home from the protests, give yourself some time to relax and unwind with some unadulterated black joy. The Wiz Live will be available starting at 11 a.m. Pacific on Friday, and will come down at 11 a.m. on Sunday. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Patreon backers get rewards like stickers in the mail, a copy of my book Defining Marriage, and also exclusive access to the Patreon-only podcast Cozy Pants, in which I talk to my partner James about the entertainment that's bringing us joy right now. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get access to those benefits. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com, and join us for the next live stream on June 20th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my other podcasts, Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag queens on epic fantasy quests. The theme song for the show is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.